Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. You're listening to Robert Johnson singing his song Crossroads Blues. It's one of the most famous tunes to come out of the Mississippi Delta. Its most famous phrase, going down to the crossroads, inspired the title of a book by our guest this hour, historian Aram Gutsuzian. He chose it to describe a 1966 civil rights march led by James Meredith, the Air Force veteran who struggled to enroll at the University of Mississippi in 1962, sparked riots and bloodshed that forced the Kennedy administration to confront a diehard segregationist state government. 4 years later, James Meredith was shot while he was leading a march through Mississippi to register African Americans to vote. James Meredith survived, but Aram Gutsuzian calls the march a crossroads for America's civil rights leadership because it saw the emergence of a black power movement challenging the alliance between civil rights leaders and longtime white supporters. Aram Gutsuzian is chair of the history department at the University of Memphis, the city where James Meredith began his march against fear. Professor Gutsuzian specializes in American popular culture, African American history, and 20th century American history. His previous books include Kings of the Court, Bill Russell and the Basketball Revolution, The Hurricane of 1938, and a biography of actor Sidney Poitier. His latest is Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. Aram Gutsuzian, thank you very much for joining us here on Midday on WYPR in Baltimore.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you on the show. And, you know, considering the previous titles of your books, I just wonder, how did you get to the Meredith March? Because you're a historian and author, and you just don't climb on one horse and ride it forever. You have a wide interest in things. So is this just a lively sense of curiosity, or is there something that unites those books in your research?
Well, I think there is some unity between the among the three books. But as you say, I do jump a little bit from topic to topic. It helps keep me interested. It helps keep me passionate about whatever it is that I'm researching and writing about. So coming to this book on the civil rights movement, in some ways, it grew out of the earlier books, and that I'd had an interest in the era, both in the biography of Sidney Poitier and in the biography of Bill Russell, and that they were dominant figures in various aspects of popular culture in the 50s and 60s in the era of the civil rights movement. But this is sort of my first, or what you might call a classic civil rights tale, in that it is about the politics of the movement itself. Yeah.
One of the issues of dealing with what we call near history, I guess, like this, is that almost no one under a certain age, and I would say maybe the age 55 or maybe 60, remembers mm-hmm. these events firsthand, right? So, mm-hmm. I mean, even mm-hmm. in the black community, I hear this older people upset because their kids or grandkids don't know much about the problems and triumphs of the civil rights era. So I think we ought to set the scene a little bit here. Why don't we start in 1962 and in Mississippi, and just describe for folks what life was like there.
Sure. Well, I mean, Mississippi has a notorious reputation in terms of race relations in the 1960s. Just to give you one illustration of that, one example of that, when civil rights workers came to Mississippi, they established these hotlines. They were called Watts lines, W-A-T-S, where they could report what was going on back to central headquarters. And they're just consistent streams of, you know, cross-burning here, violence here against a civil rights worker. These people tried to vote and were intimidated. There was a Klan attack happened on this house here. It's just a consistent stream on a daily basis of the kinds of harassment that African Americans in Mississippi and those who are active in the civil rights movement faced. It was a state that a historian at Ole Miss, James Silver, famously called the closed society. In other words, it was a society that had sort of a state-sanctioned, state-enforced, and sort of a society-wide enforced system of extremely rigid race relations based on intimidation and based on a forced labor system.
Let's remind folks about mm-hmm. James Meredith now, too. Mm-hmm. Now, it's 1962. Where on earth does he come from? He emerges as this the first black student to enroll at the University of Mississippi. Where did he come from?
James Meredith is a fascinating figure and continues to be so to some degree today. He is, in some ways, he's a product of Mississippi, but he's the product of a fairly unique environment in Mississippi. His father is a fairly substantial landowner and one of the few people in his town in central in central Mississippi who is one of the few African Americans who's registered to vote in the early 20th century and a very independent man. And he somewhat shields his children from some of the harshness of racial segregation to the degree you can be shielded being black in Mississippi in mid-century. Meredith is, when he enrolls at Ole Miss, he's an older, he's in his early 30s. He's spent 10 years in the Air Force. He has taken courses through the military at various institutions, and including at Jackson State University in Jackson. But he petitions to spend his final year at Ole Miss before he graduates. And University of Mississippi, or Ole Miss, is sort of the key to the identification of white society. It's sort of a heart in terms of how white Mississippians identify themselves and their power and their privilege in the 1960s. So for Meredith to win his court challenge and to ultimately attend this institution, as you say in your introduction, you know, sparked deadly riots. Two people died in the midst of this violence. U.S. Marshals had to protect Meredith throughout his year at Ole Miss. It forced the Kennedy administration to act in a way that they had originally been unwilling to act. So it prompted something of a constitutional crisis. And this began with the resolve of this man, James Meredith, who in a lot of ways is almost like a conservative figure, that he's very sort of individually driven. He doesn't identify as part of the civil rights movement itself. He sees it more connected to his battle against white supremacy. And he has almost these delusions of grandeur to a certain degree. He talks consistently about his divine responsibility, that he's put on earth here by God to overturn the system of white supremacy. And that's ultimately what's going to lead him to start this march 4 years later,
But where does, Aaron, where does all that come from, though? Does it come from his father? Does it come from his experience in the Air Force? Where did it come from?
It's a good question.
I mean, did someone put him up to it?
No one puts him up to it. Absolutely not. He is the most independently driven man you'll ever meet. No one is suggesting that he applied to Ole Miss. He does so on his own initiative. It's after he starts the process itself that the NAACP has pulled in to defend his court case. But it was Meredith who started it himself. So a lot of it comes from this sense of being the special person put here on earth. Some of that, again, is due to his upbringing, due to his particular circumstances in Mississippi and his family. Some of it is due to that military background. He is not a practitioner of nonviolence, as he sees it. And that's one of his criticisms of the civil rights movement, that it puts women and children on the front lines of the movement, exposes them to danger. So he's got this sort of very traditional masculine sense to him as well. So all of this is sort of building into who he is. Causes them to make these decisions. But, you know, the way that a lot of civil rights veterans, when I interviewed them about the book, talked about Meredith, they said, you know, he might have been crazy, but you needed someone who was a little bit crazy to decide he's going to integrate Ole Miss.
So does everybody say that about him? Because, I mean, he comes across a little weird in the book. I mean, almost everyone you talk to about James Meredith says, yeah, he was a little crazy.
Crazy is an unfair term.
I mean, good crazy.
Yeah, but he's certainly unique. He's certainly particular. He is odd, but at the same time, quite likable and charismatic. The first person I interviewed for the book was James Meredith. I'm very glad I did, not in the sense that I got a lot of information from him or stories in the way that I did from so many others, but more to get a sense of him as a person, that you really get a sense of his drive and of his magnetism, that he has this presence to him that helps explain who he is.
Okay, and just for the record, so we understand, he gets to Ole Miss and is actually admitted to Ole Miss by court order.
Yeah. It's an NAACP backed case. It goes through the courts. They finally say that he has to be admitted. That there's no justification for his. To deny him admission once he's been admitted, because when he was first admitted, he didn't put his race on it. And so he enters Ole Miss, and it has to be backed at that point. But this is after much back and forth in sort of the state politics of Mississippi. The governor of Mississippi, Ross Barnett, promises that he will never be able to attend the institution. There's many sort of shows, political demonstrations back and forth.
You mentioned his father earlier, and even his circumstances are pretty unique for a black man in Mississippi, a landowner. You say registered to vote?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What did you determine what, if anything, his father instructed James Meredith to do in the face of white hostility?
Well, his father, whose nickname was Cap, C-A-P, it wasn't that he sort of – it was more that he taught him lessons on how to be independent, on how to be a man. And there's a story that I tell in the book about when Meredith is just a kid, maybe 7 or 8 years old, and he goes with his father, and his father has some business dealings with a white man, a white landowner, and he knocks on the front door. Cap does. And that's against racial custom in Mississippi. You know, the black person's supposed to go to the back door. And the white man just simply doesn't answer the door. So Cap just waits out there. He knows he's home. He knows the white man is home. So he just sits outside of his door for 3 hours, 4 hours, with James Meredith, little James Meredith, sitting right next to him. Finally, the white man gets so frustrated that he walks out his front door and they conduct their business and he goes home. So for James Meredith, that's one of his early lessons in, you know, how to maintain your manhood, how to maintain your dignity in the midst of this racially oppressive system.
You touched on it a little bit. Tell us exactly what happens when he gets to Oxford and enters Ole Miss. We mentioned the riots, the bloodshed, 2 people died. How long did that go on?
The violence was really over his first night of registration, the extreme violence. And there are white supremacists coming from all over the country to protest what's going on at Ole Miss. But for the rest of that school year, he faces sort of a constant stream of harassment and isolation. There's very few whites on campus who reach out to him. He's constantly shadowed by U.S. Marshals. It's an exceptionally isolating circumstance for him, and one that some have argued probably exacerbates his tendency toward sort of being self-driven and being quirky. Mm-hmm. Those qualities existed in him prior to 1962, but by the time he graduates in 1963, it's become even more pronounced.
You describe him pretty much as a loner, mm-hmm. enigmatic figure. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't use the word crazy anymore, but although other people use that word to describe him, you just called him quirky. Mm-hmm. By the time you met him for your interview, Aram, he was, what, 80 years old or nearly 80 years old?
Nearly 80 years old, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was that like?
He is it's a very dynamic figure in certain ways. He he's in Jackson, Mississippi. He's kind of a constant presence around town. Like I have a good friend who lives in Jackson who talks about how he sees him in the Kroger all the time, the supermarket that he hangs out at the coffee station at the supermarket, and you know he sort of holds court and people come and talk to him. That he drops off his grandkids at the same school as where my friend drops off his kids for school, and he owns a small nightclub and he owns a small little convenience store, and that's where I interviewed him. So you get a little bit of a that's just to give you a sense of he's just sort of part of the fabric of Jackson, Mississippi to a certain degree. But he's also, as I tried to get at before, he has this charisma to him. So I'm meeting him in the daytime, but in his dusty nightclub. And he's telling me stories, and he very much conveys that he doesn't care what people write about him, but he's going to tell you the way that he sees it.
Mm-hmm.
Now it turns out that James Meredith ended up loving my book and wrote me a nice letter and so on, but he didn't know anything about me when he sat for the interview with me. So it turned out to be a great experience for me.
One more question before we take our first break here, Aram. He didn't care much for what we'd call it the civil rights establishment, the civil rights leaders at the time, but he needed their help to get into Ole Miss, right? So he did. Mm-hmm. He did take their help.
Yes. He certainly worked with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and Constance Baker Motley and others who helped to get his case through. And it's not that he didn't want anything to do with the civil rights movement. He wanted to be sort of paid deference to, and he wanted some influence within the civil rights movement, but he wanted to do it on his own terms. He didn't want to be part of any organization. He didn't want to take orders from anyone. He always was trying to do his own thing.
We'll take our break here. We're talking with Aram Gudsousian, chairman of the History Department at the University of Memphis and author of Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. If you grew up in the 50s or earlier, you probably remember James Meredith, the black Air Force veteran and the first black man admitted to the University of Mississippi, an event that provoked riots, as we were just talking about. The rest of our interview is going to be about the march against fear that Meredith began when he went down to Mississippi to register voters 4 years later, that became the subject of national attention when James Meredith was shot in an ambush. More of this story when we get back with Aram Gudsousian here on Midday.
Stand at the crossroads. You know me. Everybody pass me by.
Down to the Crossroads, as the title of Aram Gutsuzian's book, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. It centers on a march led by James Meredith, the first black man to enter the University of Mississippi. That was in 1962. And, you know, we move the clock up 4 years later to get to the March Against Fear, or what James Meredith called the March Against Fear. And I want to do a couple of things here, Aram Gutsuzian, since I mentioned near history and how we need to sort of go over some things for younger people who didn't live through this these times. So 1962, James Meredith enters the University of Mississippi. You said he graduated in 63? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
We get to 1964, and we're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then in 1965, we have the passage of the Voting Rights Act.
That's right.
All right.
And those two acts together are just beginning to have just a bit of influence in terms of the way that black Southerners live mm-hmm. by 1966.
We'll talk a little bit about James Meredith after Ole Miss. He graduates in 63. Mm-hmm. What does he do immediately after graduating?
He's kind of searching for his place. He moves to Washington, D.C. and tries to start an educational fund, but he quickly abandons that idea. He's offered a fellowship to study at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria, and he accepts it. It's supposed to be a three-year fellowship, but he leaves after 1 year. He's unsatisfied with it. He goes to Columbia in New York City and attends law school. So by the summer of 1966, he has finished his first year of law school at Columbia. But he is, in some ways, kind of dropped off the radar screen in terms of the major civil rights figures. In fact, there was a headline in the New York Amsterdam News, African-American newspaper, in 65 that said, "Whatever happened to James Meredith?" You know, and it sort of traced his story, but he was no longer the major figure that he was before. Now, he still had, of course, notoriety based on what had happened at Ole Miss, but he wasn't Martin Luther King. He wasn't James Farmer. He wasn't... He wasn't John Lewis. He wasn't Roy Wilkins. He wasn't one of these major figures of the civil rights movement in the mid-1960s, at least until the March Against Fear in June of 66.
Okay, June of 66, and the months leading up to that, is James Meredith back in Mississippi?
He is. His family is here, and he envisions a return to Mississippi. He, in planning this march, is writing to officials in Mississippi, and saying, you know, I'm exploring a political career in Mississippi in the future, maybe a run for lieutenant governor, maybe a run for governor. And he envisions this, what he calls a walk, not a march, because it's really sort of his walk as he sees it. It's going to be a 220-mile walk from Memphis, Tennessee to Jackson, Mississippi, along Highway 51, which is a road that has particular significance to him. He's driven up and down it many times on his way back to Memphis, and especially during the Ole Miss crisis, he was always going up and down 51 because he was staying in Memphis often during the court aspect of it. So he sees this as sort of a traditional road for black Mississippi. And by walking down this Highway 51, the idea is that he'll do two things. One is that he will encourage people to register to vote. As we mentioned, the Voting Rights Act had passed the previous year. So you're just starting to see the beginning of that having an influence on Mississippi politics by 1966. Mississippi had the lowest rates of voter registration, under 10%, prior to the passage of the Voting Rights Act. By 1966, roughly 30% of African Americans have registered to vote. So it's just beginning to have a little bit of political influence in that regard. The other thing that Meredith says is that this will help to sort of conquer the culture of fear in Mississippi. Part of the reasons blacks don't register to vote is that they fear white intimidation. They fear violence. They fear the loss of credit from white landowners. They fear the loss of jobs. So if James Meredith, still probably the most hated black man in Mississippi based on the Ole Miss crisis, can walk through Mississippi unharmed, then other black people will be inspired to fight against this culture of fear as well.
What's interesting about the formation of this idea and the march itself is that he did it on his own. That he really wasn't associated with the CORE or the NAACP, or the Urban League, any of those Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He wasn't associated with any of those groups, right?
That's absolutely true. Again, he's very much just does it based on his own personal ideas and his own personal impulse. So when he puts out a press release before his walk, and people contact these various Memphis officials, because there's a Memphis branch of the NAACP and CORE and so on. And there's, you know, across the black political spectrum here in Memphis. And they don't know anything about it. Like, it's news to us. Even he has a good friend, a guy named A.W. Willis, who's associated with the Memphis NAACP, who had been his attorney of record during the Ole Miss crisis. He didn't even know the Meredith was marching until he arrived in Memphis.
So James Meredith starts at the Peabody, am I right, the Peabody Hotel in Memphis?
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
He picked that as a starting point for what reason? Just a place for the press to assemble, or?
It's somewhat in the heart of downtown Memphis. It also has a pretty strong symbolic value in that it's sort of seen as sort of the famous line here in the South is that the Mississippi Delta begins in the lobby of the Peabody Hotel. Mm. And that is where sort of the wealthy whites from Mississippi come to congregate. And Memphis is sort of the gateway out of the Delta and into the Delta. And it's sort of a bastion of white privilege. So Meredith starting his walk outside that door does carry sort of an extra symbolic weight.
And is anyone with him? This, by the way, is what, June 5th? I have it as June 5th, 1966?
That's correct. It's okay. Sunday, June 5th. He has a few people. He's not put out sort of a general call for marchers, but he's also said, hey, if you want to come walk with me, you can. But you have to be a man, and you have to be independent. You know, you shouldn't be relying on the generosity of local people along the way. We don't want to expose them to danger. And you have to be self-sufficient. He's said maybe you want to travel in teams. So there he has about four people who are with him early in the walk. One of them is a friend of his from New York. The other is a minister who sort of feels compelled by conscience to walk with Meredith. Another is a guy named Sherwood Ross, who is a press agent who'd also worked for the Urban League. And he's sort of taken by Meredith, and he's based in the North, but he wants to experience the Southern Civil Rights Movement for himself, so he decides to accompany him. And the fourth is a local man from Memphis who's active in the NAACP here, who decides while he's driving home from church that day and listening to the radio reports, you know, about an hour before the walk's supposed to begin, he's like, I think I'll walk too.
I think I'll go these 220 miles with James Meredith.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And now James Meredith is not armed. He's not carrying a weapon. But we know that he had a certain feeling about the whole nonviolence aspect of the civil rights movement, skeptical of it or disagreed with it. I wish, Aram, you could talk a little bit about that, his attitude on that front.
Sure. And in some ways, Meredith's viewpoint on nonviolence was one that was fairly common among many African Americans of that time. It's sort of been hidden under the media image and the popular image of these nonviolent demonstrations and of the ethic of Martin Luther King. But Meredith was a critic of nonviolence for a couple reasons. One, as I mentioned earlier, he argued that it exposed women and children to danger. And that if African Americans wanted equality and respect, that they needed to have their men at the forefront. And the other aspect of that was that he said, look, this is a violent nation. Grows out of his experience in the military. You know, we're fighting a war in Vietnam by 1966. We're a nation that respects violence and force. So if African Americans want respect and want equality, they have to be willing to fight back if they are attacked.
But he did not arm himself.
No. In fact, on the night before his walk, he was weighing back and forth between whether to carry a Bible or a gun. And this was very symbolic, right? Because if he carried the Bible, he knew he was putting himself into the fabric of the civil rights movement, into this ethic of Christian sacrifice, and he knew that would help to gain support and sympathy for his walk. And that's ultimately what he chose. But on the other hand, he thought maybe he should bring the gun because he knew that there would be hostile whites who might want to attack him. And in fact, he regretted not bringing the gun.
Aram Gudsousian is our guest, historian Aram Gudsousian. His book is Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. The Meredith, of course, a reference to James Meredith. On the jacket of the book is a photograph of the march, or some of the folks who took part in the march. Is James Meredith the man with the pith helmet?
He is. He is.
So a Bible and a pith helmet. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, that's right. Okay. And he's sort of, in some ways, I think he's sort of spoofing the idea of that he's going on like a safari through Mississippi by wearing this pith helmet. He's also got a walking stick that was a gift from when he was in Nigeria from a chief that he'd met there. But he's also carrying the Bible, right? So that's his sort of balance, if you will.
Now, I'm going to say this because folks who are listening someplace near a computer or a smartphone may want to see this. There's a photograph, famous photograph of
James Meredith, not the one that's on the jacket of Aram Gutsuzian's book, but a photograph that's become sort of, I would say, iconic of the civil rights movement. Was taken by an Associated Press photographer who won the Pulitzer Prize for this photograph. And it shows James Meredith without the Bible and without the pith helmet sprawled on asphalt on the road. And let's talk about what happened next to James Meredith.
Sure. So it's June 6th. This is the second day of his walk. The first day of the walk basically took him from Memphis to the border between Tennessee and Mississippi. So on the second day of his walk, it's the first day that he's in Mississippi. And he first comes to the town of Hernando, which is the first town you'll encounter heading south on Highway 51. And this is an experience that very much buoys him, that makes him feel like he is starting to succeed in his mission. Because there's about 150 African-Americans who are in the town square waiting for him. They cheer for him. They shake his hand. They promise that they're going to register to vote. And it feels like kind of a triumphant moment for Meredith, because surrounding this community of black people are on the rest of the square are hostile whites who are just glaring at them and furious that African Americans are demonstrating, so to speak. So he continues his walk southward. It's the late afternoon, June 6, 1966. And remember, this isn't a mass march. There aren't tons of marchers, but there are police cars, there are press, there's a few FBI agents, you know, all these people monitoring the march. But as he's walking south and they're going over this sort of gently dipping stretch of road, a white man jumps out from the gully and yells, "James Meredith!" And he says, "I only want James Meredith!" And he pulls out a rifle and he shoots. And then he walks closer and he shoots again. And then he walks even closer and he shoots again. He shoots three times. And he strikes James Meredith with at least two of those shots. He shoots him, ultimately we'll learn, with birdshot. So there's tons of pellets that are lodged into him. But that's what leads to that famous photograph that won the Pulitzer Prize, as you mentioned, by Jack Thornell, that shows him writhing on the highway. And for a moment, law enforcement almost seems to be paralyzed. They seem like they're shocked by what happened, and they don't react quickly. But ultimately, they arrest this man who shot him. And that is what turns what had been really one man's walk into a huge moment in the civil rights movement. It's a civil rights extravaganza. Over the next 3 weeks, you're going to see basically every major figure in the civil rights movement come south, determined to carry on Meredith's march, and it's going to lead to these incredible debates over the future of black politics. It's going to lead to these very inspiring moments for African Americans. It's going to lead to some pretty harrowing violence. It's going to lead to finally the call for black power, which really comes to define the next generation in this freedom struggle.
The photograph that the Aram Gutsuzians are referring to there, that I referred to, can be found on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. We also tweeted it out a little while ago, so you can see that photograph. And I think a lot of people will recognize it. But Aram, I think what might surprise folks who remember this history or lived through it, that's the same man who integrated the University of Mississippi. In my mind, that was never clear to me, or I'm not sure I understood that those two things were connected. I know this photograph; it's a famous photograph, but I don't think I knew that was James Meredith from Ole Miss.
Oh, that's interesting. Memory can play tricks on us sometimes, and the way that we remember historical events can be very odd. And I very much got this experience as I was interviewing people who had participated in the march, and they would say, "No, this for certain happened in this town," or you know, I met with this person then, and I know from my records that that they're remembering an event and they're remembering things correctly on one level, but they don't always know the specifics. Yeah. So, a lot of times it's just how our brains work.
Well, let's just go over what happened to James Meredith that day, because this photograph shows him screaming, writhing with pain. Mm-hmm. You say he was struck by at least two of those shots from a shotgun. He was wounded in the head, neck, back, and legs. But he did survive this. And how far from Memphis were they at that point?
They were about 25, 30 miles south of Memphis.
Okay, so did they take him back to the hospital in Memphis?
He did, yeah. He would end up, an ambulance came and took him back to the hospital in Memphis. He spent a few days in Memphis and then ultimately flew back to New York City, where he recuperated during most of the march. Meredith would return at the end of the march, but for most of the march, he was not on it. So this march bore his name, and he certainly had an influence upon it, but it ceased to be James Meredith's story, if you will, after the first few days, until the last few days.
Who shot James Meredith?
Fascinating question. Everybody knows who shot him. It's a guy named Aubrey Norville. At the time, he was 40 years old. He's an unemployed hardware clerk based out of Memphis, who lived in Memphis. He continues to live in Memphis in the same house. So that's not the mystery. The mystery is why he shot him. Because Norville has no known connection to any white supremacist organization. His neighbors are mystified by it. They said, this guy never talked about race. He never talked about civil rights one way or another. Even his close family seems extremely surprised that he did this. So his actual motives, whether someone paid him to do so, why he did it, these are all sort of up for debate. And it remains an unknown because ultimately Norville will plead guilty to and never testify in court.
So there was never a trial. There was never a trial with any testimony.
Exactly. There was never a trial with any testimony.
Okay. Did he serve time in jail?
He did. He served. He was given a 5-year prison sentence, and he served about 2.5 years of that before he was paroled. And there were some intimations that there was probably a handshake deal that got him out of jail earlier, if he agreed to testify, if he agreed to plead guilty, because that way it wouldn't become another big news story.
Right.
This is the deal the Mississippi officials made with him.
Okay, Aubrey James Norville, or Norvell. Who served only 18 months for, what, the attempted murder of James Meredith?
Exactly. Wow. And one of the fascinating things about this shooting is the way the people cried conspiracy. Now, remember when I was talking about the shooting, it seemed like law enforcement was very slow to act. So many civil rights sympathizers assumed that Mississippi officials were in on the deal, that they must have arranged with this guy to let the shooting happen. They were too slow to react. How could they not protect him, et cetera? But the flip side of that was that many white Mississippians were furious about this shooting. Why? Because it turned what had been a walk that was getting some media attention and so on, but wasn't a massive news story. It turned it into this major civil rights demonstration that would course through the roads of Mississippi, that would bring all this federal attention, that would bring all the national and international media to Mississippi, and will lead to Mississippi again being sort of demonized in the eyes of the nation as this bastion of white supremacy. So Norville wasn't from Mississippi, right? He was from Memphis. So they said, this guy's an outsider, A. B, he must have been paid by the civil rights movement to wound James Meredith, this into a huge news story. So they cried conspiracy right back. Now, there's no basis to that theory whatsoever. It doesn't make any sense. But the fact that each side was able to use Norville based on his silence is kind of a fascinating little subplot in this story.
Wow, it's 1966, and Norville has never given an interview, never explained why he shot James Meredith.
No, he has rebuffed many interview requests, including those by me.
By me is Aram Gudsousian, our guest in this hour of Midday, historian at the University of Memphis. His book is Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. Dan Rodericks here on Midday. We'll continue our story, our conversation in just a moment. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Rodericks here. Down to the Crossroads, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear. That's the title of Aram Gudsousian's book about James Meredith and the March Against Fear, June 1966. And I wanted to ask you this question, Aram. A lot of Northerners could never understand the pure hatred, the loathing that the Southern whites expressed for blacks who were marching, trying to register to vote. And you're a Northerner who's taught in the South now for, I don't know, how many years? How many years have you been down in Tennessee?
10 years now.
Ten years. Mm-hmm. And you're right in the city where this march began. So what are your reflections on that? What's your explanation for that?
Well, I think for many white Southerners of the time, they wouldn't say we hated black people. They would say we loved black people, that we took care of them. That they especially in Mississippi, and particularly in the Mississippi Delta where this march was detoured, there's a strong myth, if you will, of paternalism, that we look out after our black people, that they're like family to us, and sort of in some ways extending a myth that dates back to slavery. Now, if you're gonna if there's a myth, it's the idea that, oh, this was a terrible time that happened in the past, but we're past that, you know. And typically, that is, you know, sort of the narrative that is used on the more, in more conservative ends to sort of talk past race, right? To say this was a problem and we solved it, and that's that. I would say those are the main ways in which people talked about it. So when white Southerners got angry about the civil rights movement, they very rarely turned their wrath in public upon local blacks. It was more that they often used the tags of outside agitators and of communists. These were sort of the ways in which they were able to sort of try to scar the civil rights movement.
Now, James Meredith, of course, was wounded. You say he was treated in Memphis and then went to New York for some treatment. So he was off the march for a while, but did later rejoin it. But in that period there, did any single leader emerge? You talked about this convergence where different civil rights groups descended on, where were they now? By now they were in Mississippi, right? They were,
Memphis remained the sort of the key headquarters, especially for the first week and a half or so of the march, because, you know, people would fly into Memphis, and that was sort of the key where decisions were made until they got deeper into Mississippi, and then the leaders were sort of congregating in Mississippi as well.
Okay, so as it became a big deal, was there any other leader, a single leader, who emerged for the march?
Not a single leader. One of the sort of dramatic aspects of the march is the way that there were these sort of consistent battles for influence going on among many of the civil rights leaders. So when Meredith was shot, the major civil rights organizations, of which there were really five at the time, the head of the NAACP was Roy Wilkins, and the head of the Urban League was Whitney Young. And these were the more conservative, more established organizations, very much oriented toward Washington, D.C., and Congress, and the White House, and public policy. And they were the largest, most well-funded organizations. Then there was Martin Luther King's organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was, in the political spectrum here, was more moderate, but was much more willing to use nonviolent direct action, was moving into voter registration, was just beginning a very ambitious campaign in Chicago, trying to take the tactics of the Southern movement and bring them to a northern city. And then the other two organizations are SNCC, or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, or the Congress of Racial Equality. And SNCC has a new leader in Stokely Carmichael. CORE has a new leader in Floyd McKissick. And that's reflective of these organizations' move toward a more radical or militant stance, that they are moving more toward an orientation in concentrating aspects of black political power, whether that is in the rural black belt or in northern cities, and trying to use black power as black political power and black as a lever. To say, you know, and to focus much less on the issue of integration. As Stokely Carmichael says, integration is irrelevant. Really, the question is how can black people band together and use their power for their own ends?
Is he credited with using the term black power? And is the march against fear this in June 66, is this the first time the nation's hearing this phrase used that way?
Yes, absolutely. So Stokely Carmichael is sort of seen as the key architect of black power. Part of that is the way that he's thrust into the spotlight through the Meredith March. He's just been the leader of SNCC for a month. He's a guy who has a reputation as somewhat of a master organizer, had spent time in the Mississippi Delta, had just begun this an organizing campaign in Alabama in Lowndes County, where he's organized an all-black third political party. But he's all of a sudden thrust into this as a national figure on the march, and he's a man of immense political gifts, a great charisma, a great ability to connect to people, a great ability to talk to different audiences in different language, different language cues, whether he's in the North, whether he's in the South, whether he's talking to the media, whether he's talking to poor black people in the Mississippi Delta. The phrase black power, he's not the first to use the phrase. I mean, Richard Wright had titled a book about African politics, black power in the 1950s. Adam Clayton Powell had used the slogan, the congressman from Harlem. Others had used the phrase. And SNCC had already used the slogan black power for black people in their campaign in Alabama, in their organizing campaign in Alabama. So it's not like the words themselves were something new. But what occurred on the march was it was the first time that it was used as a rallying cry, the first time that it was used as a slogan, and people recognized it as a historical turning point right from the beginning. You know, the media recognized it as soon as the cry of black power was unveiled in Greenwood, Mississippi, in the Delta, on June 16 of 1966. People at the time said this is a turning point in the civil rights movement.
Was Stokely Carmichael already associated with the Black Panther Party? at that time?
The Black Panther Party, that can get a little tricky in terms of what was the Black Panther Party. So there was this party in Alabama that I mentioned. This was an all-black rural party in Lowndes County, Alabama, which was a 90% black county in Alabama, where they'd been organizing since 1965, deciding, you know, we're no longer going to integrate into the traditional Democratic Party because that's still a white supremacist party in the South. So let's create our own party. And they had for their symbol, it was a Black Panther. So people were calling that a Black Panther Party, or calling that the Black Panther Party in 65, in 66. The Black Panthers that we know of, right, of Fred Hampton and so on, and is starts later in 1966 in the Bay Area, in Oakland.
Right.
And they'd use the name because, you know, they borrow it, if you will, from SNCC and call themselves the Black Panthers.
Okay. So they weren't associated.
They weren't directly associated, no.
Okay.
No. Carmichael later, in I want to say 67 or 68, for a brief time joins the Black Panthers, creates an alliance with them, but they are not directly associated with each other in 66, no.
I'm curious about when this phrase started being used, black power, and the press started using it and reporting it to the public. What was the reaction, as a public reaction? What was the response of law enforcement during the march?
Mm-hmm. So black power is immediately controversial, and it's immediately... has many meanings depending on who you are and how you want to read it. For the media, they tend to almost directly contrast it simply with Martin Luther King's ethic of nonviolence. They say if King is nonviolent and Black Power is a critique of the old patterns of the Civil Rights Movement, then it must mean violence. While for most Black Power practitioners, they would qualify it as self-defense, you know, which is different from, say, violent revolution. For many black people in Mississippi, they tend not to read it in militant terms. They tend not to read it in violent terms. They tend to say, I mean, they're poor, they're black, they have no power. Of course, they believe in the idea of black power, that it's something that is going to encourage development of resources, development of a pride in your history, of your culture, in your identity. These are all things that continue to shape, you know, of course, how African Americans think today. So black power has these, if you will, these positive ramifications to it. But it's a contested term, right? It is both something that is unifying for the black community, but also alienating in terms of those who are more integrated into or focused on integration into a larger community. It's very uplifting for many people, but also very discouraging for others. They see it as the end of the traditional civil rights movement, this period of sort of a moral upswing. So it's quite a contested term right from the beginning.
Yeah. And it's associated with, at least in your book, in the history as you tell it here, a dissolution of this alliance that we see in photographs from the time in newsreel and film of, you know, black hands and white hands and arms locked together in marches. This longtime alliance between black civil rights activists and their liberal white friends and supporters in the white community.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there are white activists who support black power, you know, throughout. And for many, you talk to white activists from the time and they say, well, you know, we were always fighting for black power. We always wanted blacks to achieve political power and pride in themselves and pride in their identity. So there are continuities there, but there also are breaks, as you say. Particularly, it's a disillusion with institutions, right? With the federal government is not someone you appeal to for help. It is an institution which is helping to repress you as the viewpoint of many black power activists. Yeah. You can look to, you know, there's no point in looking to religious organizations and labor organizations the way that people like Martin Luther King and other black liberals are calling for. They say, you know, this is futile. Ultimately, the only way that we're going to achieve a real equality is first we need to develop a strength amongst ourselves. Only then can we legitimately integrate into American society.
Tell us about the rest of the march. Mm-hmm. How long did it go on? How many people mm-hmm. joined it? Did they register blacks as they set out to do in Mississippi? And then, you know, tell us about James Meredith rejoining the march.
Sure. So, I mean, and that's the bulk of the book, right? Is these 3 weeks in Mississippi in which it's full of these incredible moments. So they start to hold these voter registration rallies. The first of them is in a town called Batesville, where they register a man who's 106 years old. It's the first time he's ever registered to vote in his life. This is a man who was born a slave and is now registering to vote for the first time in his life in 1966. It turns out they end up registering over 4,000 voters along the march route. Over the course of 3 weeks, when they get to the town of Grenada, this is a historically very repressive town. There is no real civil rights movement in Grenada prior to the arrival of the Meredith Marchers, but they helped to inspire this very important local movement. and it includes this very symbolic time when they rally around the memorial to a Confederate soldier, and they stick an American flag on it, and they refer to Jefferson Davis as the Joker up here, and many whites see this as grave an insult as you can imagine. Senator James Eastland, senator from Mississippi, says, "What's next? Are they going to desecrate the graves of Confederate soldiers and drag them through the streets?" So there, you know, there's these symbolic battles over Civil War memory that are going on. They decide to detour the march. They go off of Meredith's planned route on Highway 51, and they go into the Mississippi Delta. And they do so because this is the region where there's the largest black population. There's black majorities in many counties. It's also where SNCC, in particular, has already done a lot of organizing dating back to the early 1960s, where this is the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. SNCC's headquarters in the summer of 1964 were in Greenwood, Mississippi. And it's no accident that that is where they decide to unveil the chant for black power. As the march goes further south, there's these huge rallies that go on. There's these debates over black power among the many civil rights leaders. When they get to Canton, Mississippi, this is one of the most extraordinary stories in the march. Canton is only about 15 miles north of Jackson, their final destination. And there have been all along the way, there have been all these sort of debates going back and forth with white authorities over what land they can use, because they set up their tents on these land. And sometimes white authorities are very accommodating. They say, sure, use this land. They just want to get the marchers, you know, moving on. But when they get to Canton, the local authorities decide to hold a very hard line, and they ultimately get support from the state police to do so. And when the marchers try to use try to set up their tents on land where earlier civil rights workers had been arrested, the police respond with tear gas. And they don't use tear gas just to sort of, you know, for crowd control, to push the people off the land. Rather, they use it to punish them. They're shooting it in all directions. As the smoke is clearing, the police come in and they're whacking people with nightsticks and they're kicking them. There's, you know, scores of injuries. It's an exceptionally brutal moment. They also take a side trip to Philadelphia, Mississippi, in west central Mississippi. This is where there have been the murders of the three civil rights workers 2 years earlier.
Aaron,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. We need to wrap up here.
Sure.
And we're just getting to the denouement, the climax of all this. But we'll tell folks they'll have to read about it in your book. I certainly appreciate you being with us tonight. We're just running out of time here.
Sure, I understand.
What a rich story this is. Down to the Crossroads is the name of Aram Gudsousian's book, Civil Rights, Black Power, and the Meredith March Against Fear, which he was just describing. They ended up in Jackson, Mississippi, and James Meredith was able to recover and rejoin them and finish the march there. Aram, thank you very much for being with us today, for telling us this bit of American history. I appreciate it.
Dana, it was my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Yep, thank you very much. Aram Gudsousian, who's the chair of the history department at the University of Memphis, where that march began, June 1966. Hope you enjoyed our program today. This is Dan Rodrigues for our staff here at Midday. Have a great afternoon, a great weekend. We'll see you again soon.
You can run. Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer and director is Jonathan Ahrens. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, and Anna Muckerman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.